Good morning, everybody. Hope you found a place to park. I know parking was an issue, but you know what? That is an issue, but guess what? We have tourists coming to this facility, and it's a beautiful facility, so that's a good problem to have. Well, welcome to the fourth annual State of the Economy event, an event produced by your Greater Oklahoma City Chamber. As Oklahoma City responds to the ever-changing global economy, we know that our chamber members need to be positioned to succeed in uncertain times. And today we hope to give you that information that will help position you so that providing you the insights for the coming months, both in terms of opportunities as well as areas of maybe some uncertainty. But before I introduce our panel members and today's keynote speaker, I want to give you a snapshot of how we're doing as a community. Because of your hard work and the foundation laid in the past few years, our regional economy has continued to see growth in 2014. Now, while the final numbers for 2014's performance aren't calculated just yet, our preliminary numbers indicate that employment is expected to have increased by about 15,000 jobs, or 2.6% over the past year. That's 5,000 more jobs than we forecasted. That's a great performance. And with those numbers, though, the Metro will have outpaced the nation's employment rate by a full percentage point. Oklahoma City sectors with strongest gains include oil and gas, administrative support, and construction. Through the end of October, as part of the Chamber's Forward Oklahoma City Economic Development efforts, Chamber-assisted companies have announced or added 5,700 jobs, $310 million in payroll, and over $500 million in capital investment. Now, this includes both new-to-market firms as well as the expansion from existing companies. And it has been especially a strong year, with each category I mentioned surpassing 2013's performance at the same time last year. The Greater Oklahoma City Chamber is continuing its multi-year strategy of focusing its economic development efforts on key industry sectors, those sectors being aerospace, bioscience, energy, advanced manufacturing, and logistics/distribution. The success of that strategy has been evidenced by positive job gains and an unemployment rate that has been among the five lowest in the country for large metros. Five lowest in the country. Isn't that awesome? And even more so, for 45 consecutive months. So for Oklahoma City, preliminary forecasts for 2015 indicate that our region will experience about a 2% growth in employment, or 12,000 jobs. However, the performance of Oklahoma City's economy in 2015 could be somewhat dependent on the price of oil and gas, something that we'll discuss with our panelists later in the program. But we remain optimistic, but recognize that an uncertain future can bring unexpected challenges. So it's critical that the business community remains united in its efforts to ensure that the Greater Oklahoma City region continues to be a place that will attract new investment as well as a talented and qualified workforce. So today, we'll hear from a local panel of economists as well as a respected national forecaster about issues that are critical to the Oklahoma City area. The economic trends we discuss here today will undoubtedly influence how we approach our business strategy on a day-to-day basis. But before our panelists speak, and before our keynote, I'd like to invite today's signature sponsor, Arvest Bank, to make a few comments. So please welcome to the stage Executive Vice President and Regional Manager for Arvest Bank, Brad Krieger.
Again, good morning and welcome to the fourth Greater Oklahoma City Chamber State of the Economy luncheon. And if you look back at when we started this, trust me, the economy is a lot better than when we started. So I'm Brad Krieger with Arvest Bank, and we're honored to be the signature sponsor once again. How fortunate are we to here in Greater Oklahoma City to have the low unemployment, acknowledgement of a vibrant business community, and a high quality of lifestyle. This is not only recognized locally, regionally, but also nationally and internationally. This is one of those 20-year overnight success stories that continues to fuel momentum and shows the can-do attitude, resiliency, and drive of its people and the business community. But we can't rest on that momentum or that complacency. We at Arvest appreciate the opportunity to be here today and be a part of the continued renaissance of Greater Oklahoma City. And hopefully you have seen the Arvest consumer sentiment survey that came out. It's the second one that we're doing, and we're doing that in conjunction with OCU and OU, and it's very much patterned after the Michigan consumer sentiment survey, and hopefully you'll find the information very good. But again, thank you for being here, and have a good lunch.
Appreciate your remarks, Brad. We appreciate you very much, Arvest Bank, being our signature sponsor. All right, let's introduce our panel of Oklahoma economists. We'll have a brief Q&A after I have about six questions I'm going to pose to our panelists, and then we're going to open it up to Q&A from the audience. And we have microphones, so if you'll do, you'll raise your hand, and I'll give you instructions later because I know that's hard to follow while you're eating your salads. So our first panelist is the Senior Associate Dean for Economic Development and Impact. Please welcome Dr. Robert Doffenbach. Appreciate it. Also joining us is the Executive Director of the Stephen C. Agee Economic Research and Policy Institute at Oklahoma City University. Please welcome Dr. Russell Evans. Our next panelist is an economist and dean of the University of Central Oklahoma's College of Business. Please welcome Mickey Heppner. Feel like I'm introducing your starting lineup here. And our last panelist is Director of Center for Applied Economic Research at Oklahoma State University. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Dan Rickman. I'll move over here, and Dr. Schimmer, and I'll introduce you later. You go enjoy your lunch. Y'all ready for the hot seat? Okay. Six questions, so please continue enjoying your salads. I'm going to ask the entire panel, so whoever would like to chime in, you just give me the little nod, okay? Is that cool? This first question... In looking at the Oklahoma economy, what are the areas that concern you the most? And on the flip side, where are you most encouraged? Don't answer all at once.
Gonna go down the line.
Oh. Dan, you're on the hot seat.
Okay, I'll start. Well, I'll start with where I'm most encouraged, because I'll start with the positive. I'm most encouraged in terms of statewide. I think Oklahoma City is obviously the bright spot. You know, the momentum that they have here with the energy sector, the aerospace cluster, the MAPS projects and the quality of life. I think this is really, you know, an engine of growth for the state right now. And so this is what I see as a bright spot. Also in Tulsa, I think, you know, mid-level manufacturing has performed very well and will continue to perform well also. My concerns, which we'll get to in one of our questions, probably stem around a lot with education. I think it's got a lot of attention. It really is a problem. This could really adversely affect our economy if we don't kind of get in a better path with that. Also, we're very underrepresented in the so-called STEM jobs, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. If you go outside the energy sector, the aerospace sector, we're extremely underrepresented. And so this is really an area of growth in the country, and it's a place that we seem to be lagging.
Thank you.
For me, first of all, let me thank the Oklahoma City Chamber for hosting this event again. This is the fourth time we've done this, and we have food plus discussion about economics. To me, this is heaven.
Food and economic discussions. Yeah. Okay.
So thank you again. For me, the biggest concern that I see facing this state, the concern I have for this state, is more of a state-level issue, and that seems to be our unwillingness as a state to focus on investing for our future. whether it's investing in infrastructure, investing in our children, investing in quality of life, we seem to be consistently choosing to focus more on today instead of tomorrow. And so we have roads and bridges that are consistently ranked among the nation's worst, certainly not what you would expect in a dynamic, vibrant economy. We have a rail infrastructure that certainly isn't conducive, whether we're talking about freight or passenger rail, to what you would typically see in a dynamic, thriving metropolitan kind of economy. We have a state educational system where per-pupil funding ranks among the nation's lowest year after year. And then over the last 6 years, since 2008, real per-pupil expenditures in common education have fallen by 23% in Oklahoma, which ranks worst among the 50 states. And keep in mind, we didn't face the same fiscal crisis that other states did. We didn't face the same impact from the Great Recession that other states did. We just chose not to invest in our children. And then a couple of years ago, we made a significant choice not to expand Medicaid and accept billions of federal dollars to do so. On this stage 2 years ago at this event, I pointed out how from an anti-poverty perspective, that was a mistake because it will leave 150,000 Oklahomans behind. From an economic development perspective, though, it was an incredible mistake because it leaves on the table billions of dollars of federal funds, dollars that would have flowed to Oklahoma's health care providers, making our rural hospitals more viable, increasing incomes and jobs in the healthcare sector, increasing tax collections for the state, and we chose not to make that investment, again, leaving billions of dollars on the table. Now, I think one of the things that I see is a true bright spot is what we're seeing in Oklahoma City. This organization, the Greater Oklahoma City Chamber, should be very proud of the work it's done over the last two decades to help improve the quality of life in Oklahoma. But keep in mind, the renaissance we're seeing in Oklahoma City, the tremendous progress we've made the last few decades, came about not because we cut taxes, but because we raised them, because the civic leaders and the business leaders of this state came together to focus on making investments in infrastructure, investments in children, investments in quality of life that have led this city forward. And until our state leaders get that same message, until our state leaders take that same emphasis on thinking more about tomorrow than today, our state and its people will never reach its full potential.
Thank you, Mickey and Dan. I tell you, we are not paying them for their positive remarks about Oklahoma City, so just know these are from the experts.
That doesn't mean we won't take money.
Oh, okay. We'll talk later. All right. Russell, you're on deck.
Well, yeah, so many things there in Mickey's comments that it's hard for me to remember what the original question was and which of the many things I'd like to say
help?
I want to say.
Okay.
But let me focus sort of my opening comments on where I'm looking in terms of the short-run economic outlook just in the next year or two. I think when we think about Oklahoma City's trajectory out of, and the state of Oklahoma, our trajectory out of the Great Recession, what we really saw was disproportionate growth in a couple of sectors. And so when you look at the very bottom in 2010, where our average monthly employment bottomed out through 2012, about one out of every four state private sector jobs was an oil and gas job. If you expand that to include some manufacturing sectors and some construction sectors that are related to oil and gas, things like pipeline construction, pipeline transportation, machinery manufacturing, fabricated metal products manufacturing, when you expand those subsections, it turns out that about one out of every two jobs, private sector jobs created in those first two or three years out of the recession, were in that very small subset of industries. And then those industries sort of plateaued a little bit in mid-2013. And so from mid-2013 into the first half of 2014, oil and gas employment sort of went flat, and we're back up a little bit from where we were a year ago. Manufacturing activity in the city, at least, shed a few jobs. And so I'm in a situation where I'm looking at the economic outlook, and I can look at the numbers, and from day to day I look at the numbers, and one day I look at it, I think the glass is half full, and one day I look at the numbers, I think the glass is half empty. And it's one of those years where I'm really having a hard time sort of settling in on a model and a forecast for 2015 and 2016. Overall, I think I'm settling in on a more optimistic forecast. I think that the pros outweigh the cons in this situation, but we are still waiting, at least I'm waiting to see in the numbers what I would consider to be more robust cross-sector growth that reaches out across not just manufacturing and mining, and now what we see today in construction, leisure and hospitality, a few sectors, we really see that robust growth going forward. So I have a half-full, half-empty perspective that I think I'm hoping the panelists today will convince me it's half-full.
We'll ask that later on. Thanks, Russell. Bob.
Well, real quick, I'd just say that what we have in this state is fairly good growth, particularly in employment, a little bit above the national average, but not much. What we have in Oklahoma City is 3.6% expansion in employment year over year. What the threat is to both the state and to the city to some degree is the price of oil. We've seen it fall from $105 West Texas Intermediate in just a few short months, and this morning it was struggling to stay above $75 and didn't. Not much of a problem so long as we stabilize at the present levels. And I don't know anybody silly enough to want to hazard a guess as to where energy prices are going. But it's clear that the state has benefited greatly from the energy industry, and I think we have that that card to play for a long time in the future.
Great. Thank you, Bob. Question number two is going to focus on labor force. And so, Bob, I'm coming right back to you on this one. Seattle recently passed a citywide ordinance raising the minimum wage to $15 per hour. I remember when I bartended and I made $2.20 an hour. I got tips.
Plus tips.
But with legislation to increase the federal minimum wage stalled in Congress, proponents of a raise have turned their attention to states and cities. What are the pros and cons of that type of legislation, and should we expect to see other types of initiatives by communities as they struggle to attract talent?
As of last summer, 23 states in the District of Columbia had minimum wage laws that exceeded the national minimum wage law. This has been a focus of major state legislative initiatives this last year. 38 states introduced bills related to the minimum wage. 34 states considered increases in the state minimum wage. Many states have indexed their minimum wage laws above what the feds are mandating. And some of the increases currently that are scheduled to be on the books, like fiscal year 2017, fiscal year 2018, exceed $10, and some are as high as $11. Not Oklahoma. And frankly, I think we're right. Politically popular, yes. Minimum wage laws are very popular. Politicians are flocking to the populist approach there. But are minimum wage laws good economics? I think not, and most economists agree with me. So what are we saying here? Well, consider these rhetorical questions. Are not minimum wage laws a form of price control? And when have price controls really helped us out much? Can you really legislate the wage, the value of the marginal product of labor? I don't think so. Why do we not trust the invisible hand of the marketplace to allocate labor resources where they're needed and at the price that's needed to draw them there? Why can't we trust the market like we trust the market for, say, to make allocated decisions for, say, milk? Well, I guess that's maybe not a good example. Yeah. Are we not preventing persons whose productivity is less than the minimum wage from gaining employment? Are we not creating barriers to young people in getting a toehold in the job market, gaining skills, abilities, workforce behavior patterns that affect their productivity and future employment potential? So, no, I am not in favor of minimum wage laws. I trust the market to work. In terms of what the BLS says, and you're talking about you made as a weight person, according to the BLS, the price level since my high school days is up 7.5 times. The minimum wage, however, is up only 5.8 times. So what that means is you can take today's minimum wage, translate it back into what today's dollars would have been in the mid-60s, and you get $9.50 to $10. So you can make an argument that today's minimum wage is pretty low in comparison to history. of course, you can argue that the Fed is that the government is lying about inflation too. But I don't actually say the government lies about statistics. I just say that they're careless with the truth.
This is being recorded, Bob.
I was gonna say.
Still, I have to admit that there are a lot of studies, careful studies, that have been done, and they don't show much effect one way or the other of minimum wage laws. Some small positives, some small negatives. But I think there are a lot of reasons to let the market work, and particularly in regard to youth and their entry into the job market. The youth unemployment levels in this country are disgraceful, and we need to ask the question, to what extent are minimum wages actually holding us back?
Profound.
Russell? You know, I would just add to Bob's comments, and I think I agree with most of what Bob said right up until the assertion of the conspiracy theory and the government statistics. I might, case NSA is listening, I
which,
might...
Which side do you lean?
I may want to abstain from comment on that. But I think in general, I have to believe that businesses do respond to changes in the prices of inputs. And we see that across studies, and I don't know why that would be different in the labor market. And to Bob's point, most of the studies that have come out, empirical studies, have found really no great impacts one way or the other from the minimum wage laws. And I think at the risk, or maybe setting my friend Mickey up here, I would say that when we talk about minimum wage laws, you know, to Bob's point, they're really, we talk about them because they're simple to understand, they're easy to sort of articulate and easy to vote for. But in terms of really addressing a serious problem, such as growing income inequality or poverty, they're not particularly effective at addressing those two issues. And so if the question is, you know, how can we better address those issues, I would say there are ways better than minimum wage laws. I think both Mickey and Dan have done research into some alternative forms of anti-poverty measures, including incentives to increase child care, and I think there are better policies out there than minimum wage laws if that's your objective, is to try to target wage gaps and poverty.
I would just add briefly here that the benefits of raising the minimum wage have been vastly overstated by the proponents. Mm-hmm. The costs have been overstated by the opponents. Generally, there's not much of an effect, and I think generally what we found are the cities and the states that have had the greatest pressure to increase their minimum wage have been the places where the market rates for low-wage labor were already well above the minimum wage, and so there's little opposition, little impact in that kind of situation. If the purpose is to have an anti-poverty effect, Russ is absolutely right. There are much more better policies, much more effective policies to reducing the poverty effects. If the objective is to attract and retain a high-quality workforce, and keep in mind the dynamic economies aren't going to thrive and grow by attracting the low end of the wage scale. We need policies that improve the quality of life, continue doing the things that the Greater Oklahoma City Chamber is doing. So I would just urge the Chamber and its members going forward to let's not lose focus on the things that have been really successful here in Oklahoma City, and that's improving the quality of life for our residents, and not get distracted by policies that might lead us away from more effective policies.
Okay. Dan, you got anything?
I just would confirm what everybody else is saying. I think states and localities are in the best position to be setting these minimum wages. I think trying to raise that too much nationally, there's some regions that can sustain a higher minimum wage than others, and so I would leave it to states and localities to determine what they think their market could bear.
Okay. Dan, since you're talking,
okay,
let's focus on education.
Yes.
Okay. As you know, it is a top priority for businesses. Nationwide, employers are struggling with skills gap, a lack of available talent, and an aging workforce. Meanwhile, low teacher pay, curriculum standards, and overwhelming student debt remain as issues for discussion. From an economic standpoint, what path are we headed down?
Well, for the reasons you just outlined, we're on a very bad path in Oklahoma, one that could be very hazardous to our future. Teacher pay is near the bottom nationally in Oklahoma. And some research I'm doing with the person with me here today and others, even if you adjust for cost of living, even if you compare it to the wages of others in the state, we rank near the bottom. And along with that, we've been looking at retention of teachers as it relates to pay, and we find quite sizable effects that you do have teachers leaving the profession in the states that have the lower pay. And particularly, it seems to be acute amongst math and science teachers and those in computers. So sometimes the skills that we most need in our teachers, they have the most attractive alternatives. They're employable in many other occupations, and they leave. And this is where we find it to be very sensitive. So my concern is that this lack of emphasis on education and infrastructure as well, as Mickey pointed out, is leading us to what we in economics call a resource curse outcome. And a resource curse is where energy abundance leads to underperformance in other sectors of the economy. That because energy is being extracted and you're getting the benefits of that, you take your eye off the ball off the other things that we know are needed to drive the economy forward. And this has been shown around the world. They happen in countries that are resource rich. There's some evidence in the U.S. that this has happened in various regions. And I think it's going to be particularly problematic is if you look at the skill demands of the occupations that are going to be growing, those that are at the high wage end have increasing skill demands in education. And if we're not producing people in that, we're going to primarily be producing people at the bottom end. And so when you talk about poverty, you just talk about income in general and overall growth, we will suffer if we don't adequately alter our course in education right now.
Dan, you made a comment that the teachers in science and math, yes, are they exiting the teaching environment overall, or are they also, they're being attracted by other states?
Well, the only thing we've looked at so far is whether they're staying in a profession whatsoever. And what we are finding is that they're leaving the profession. I mean, our next step is we want to kind of look at where people might be moving, but we're finding them just simply leaving the profession of teaching, those who had specialized in math and science in their education training.
And that is so critical for our future.
Yes, it is.
Wow, thank you, Dan. Anybody have comments they'd like to add?
I'll just say, kind of adding on what I said earlier, we cannot have a dynamic, thriving economy without a quality education system. We cannot have a quality education system without high-quality teachers. And we cannot sustain above-average, high-quality teachers with below-average pay in the long run. And so if we really want to have a dynamic, thriving economy, we have to be willing to make the investments in our children and our teachers and our schools to help build that economy going forward. And at this point, with teacher pay ranking among the nation's lowest, with per pupil spending falling faster than in any other state in the nation, we are not making the choices we need to make to build a dynamic, thriving economy going forward.
Yeah, I have to wonder on the education side, both in primary education as well as secondary and higher education, what role technological innovation and disruption is going to play over the next generation, and what the role is for formal education. We're seeing some shifts in some other countries of almost movements back to apprenticeship-type programs and informal patterns of education. And so in a state like Oklahoma, I tend to focus more on the higher education side. I wonder, for a small private liberal arts university like the one I represent, what's our role going to be in partnering with a career tech system and a HR department at a corporation that has their own internal education program to try to generate the outcomes, the educational outcomes that we need. I think there's, I'm looking for some, I anticipate some disruptions there. On the, you know, Dan mentioned the resource curse, and I would say, and I think we'll talk about energy in a little bit in greater detail, but when you look at the resource curse, this idea of how do I leverage today's economic boom into sustainable economic development, sustainable economic activity, when you look at the resource curse, some of the symptoms you would expect to see are decreased returns to urbanization, decreased returns to education, and decreased returns to innovation. And so when you look at Oklahoma's history, you sort of see in those symptoms that maybe Oklahoma and some rural areas, oil and gas areas, have suffered from a resource curse in the sense that those areas have tended to remain rural. They've not urbanized at the rate that you would have expected. They do not seem to get the returns to education or innovation. That being said, I think the keystone industry, as Bob alluded to in his opening comments, the oil and gas industry is a much different industry today. And it's one today that requires education, requires innovation. I think we'll see some returns, some long-run returns from today's oil and gas industry if, as Bob intimated in his opening comments, that it remains a cornerstone industry for some time to come. If we have a run ahead of us, a generation or two, I think there are some good results that come out of that.
I would just say let's look at what we can affect, how we can affect change locally first. What do you have the greatest potential for changing? And that is local attention to our K-12 education system. That has always been a focus of this community. It was the first effort of the MAPS program. to revitalize the physical infrastructure of our schools. Let's look to caring for our own issues and how we can affect change, and work certainly on at the state level and regional level. Even though the state may be 49th among all states in teacher pay, the Oklahoma City region doesn't need to be.
Exactly. Well, there are a number of items in the news lately and top of mind to a lot of us, that being oil prices, the Affordable Care Act, as well as interest rates. So the fourth question I have is all about energy. And Russell, you're on this response. Earlier this month, Saudi Arabia signaled a major shift in strategy by cutting prices on its oil exports to the United States while raising prices in Asia and Europe. Oil and gas prices have declined considerably, and many people have commented that Oklahoma's economy looks a lot like it did right before in the 1980s with the oil bust at that time. What is your outlook for the energy market, and how will our local oil producers be impacted if we are truly headed into a price war?
Yeah, so I'm going to try to be brief because I think I'm sure the other panelists
have. How can you be brief with that response?
Well, that's the problem, right? And so I was thinking about this morning as I was thinking about this question. I'm sure that any one of the four of us could take 45 minutes on the topic without, you know, it's significant to what's going on in the economy. It could be a three-hour session, and I'm sure you're hoping that it does not turn into a three-hour session. So I'm going to try to be brief and sort of share some of the comments here. But when we look at the oil and gas industry and you look at what happened in 1982, I think you have to remember 1982 really was a collection of aberrations, and the pieces are not in place today for a 1982-1986 type collapse. And so while there is some stress and anxiety created from the falling oil prices and prices at $75 versus where they were at $115 or $100, not all that long ago, when you think back to 1982, there were a series of events that sort of led up from a Yom Kippur war into an oil embargo and then into an 81-82 recession that put downward pressure on prices. In Oklahoma City, you had Penn Square Bank, who was investing and selling off lending in oil and gas wells, and then was like piecing up the loans and selling them, much the way we pieced up loans based on mortgages heading into this most recent financial crisis. And so there was this sort of, when oil prices fell, the loans, the investments that were made predicated on the untenable assumption that oil prices would continue to go up indefinitely, much the same way we were making investments and mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations in 2008 that were predicated on an untenable assumption that housing prices were going to continue to go up indefinitely. And so when Penn Square Bank failed, the ripple effects reached out to the West Coast and the upper Midwest. But fundamentally, it wasn't a national issue and therefore did not require a national monetary and fiscal policy response. Oklahoma was sort of left out in the desert to cope. As we coped with this in 1986, of course, Saudi Arabia, to punish non-compliant OPEC members, floods the world with additional oil. Oil prices fall further. And what we had in that time period, when you look at it, it's really about a 15-year phenomena at least. We didn't get back to 1982 population and labor force levels in the state until 1996. And so it took us about 15 years to work through this population labor force that left the state. We didn't get back to that until almost 15 years later in 1996. On a lot of fronts, we weren't fully recovered until the early 2000s. And those pieces just aren't in place for that sort of a bust right now. And so I remain relatively optimistic. While there is some stress here at falling oil prices, I don't see that sort of a bust repeating itself. Although I've had this question six times probably in the last 3 months. And so this is a question that's on everybody's mind that we're certainly starting to address. And my closing thought on where I think oil prices are going, if I'm bold enough to predict oil prices, which I'm really not, I will say this. As you think about this sort of this game of chicken, this game theory that's taking place between U.S. producers and OPEC members, I think our ace card remains the fact that at the price of oil that makes it wholly uneconomical for us to engage in extracting that marginal barrel of oil is the price of oil that likely sets off significant social unrest in Middle Eastern countries and OPEC member nations. And so we sort of have this, there's only so far Russia and Saudi Arabia and there's only Venezuela, there's only so far they can take the bluff and let oil prices fall. Beyond a certain point, it becomes uneconomical for us, and it's a hardship on our corporations. But beyond that point for them, it keeps them from balancing their budgets and meeting their governmental requirements and sets off social unrest. And so I think there's a natural floor there that keeps us from going into a bust cycle. Stressed, sure. Bust, I don't think so.
Very, very smart. Any other response on energy?
If you look at the forecast of Energy Information Administration, they just had their short-term outlook that was released. And even our national forecaster that we use in our forecasting efforts, they really don't forecast much of an impact on production in the upcoming year. You have many producers have hedged in their prices that they deliver at. You have a lot of current plans underway. They don't anticipate that the price change we've had, and any even if it's a little bit less than where we're at, is likely to change things much in the near term. In the longer term, it really is, as Bob said, it's kind of anybody's guess. But in the near term, it doesn't seem to be much of expected of a change.
All right. Thank you. Mickey, you're on deck for Health Care and Affordable Care Act. As you know, the Affordable Care Act remains a central concern of this business community. As companies continue to face potential penalties under the employer mandate and seek to effectively comply with the law. Comply? Where'd that accent come from? given this uncertainty, what do you believe are the implications of our local companies and the state's economy?
First of all, there is some uncertainty, and the employer mandate portion of the Affordable Care Act is easily the most concerning portion of that act for me as an economist, but not necessarily for the reasons that you might think. Anytime you have a regime change, a big significant policy change, and certainly in an area and in an industry that has such a significant impact on a firm's cost structure, you're going to have uncertainty. Now, the good news is that the uncertainty is somewhat temporary. And so in 2015, employers with more than 100 employees will be required to provide health insurance to 70% of their employees or else pay a penalty of around $2,000 per employee. It goes up in 2016 to where they have to have 95% coverage, and employers with 50 or more employees have to have coverage for their employees as well. So the penalties are just going to start in 2015 and 16. But mostly those are going to be going to the firms that have more employees, more than 100 employees. And so the firms that have fewer than 50 don't ever have to pay the penalty. The uncertainty about that, because we're changing incentives, we don't quite know exactly how it's going to play out, understandably creates some uncertainty for firms. And as a result, it helps delay investment that they need to make until they see more and learn more. But again, most of the firms that have more than 100 employees are already providing health insurance to their employees. So the effect is actually relatively small for the largest firms in terms of that piece. And once we get more certainty as to how this gets enforced and how this plays out, that uncertainty goes away. The biggest issue to me with the employer mandate, though, is that it's really not necessary. It has very little impact on the overall insurance rates in the market. And if we think about other types of insurance, you know, I don't buy insurance for my house from my employer or through my employer. I don't buy insurance through my car or through my employer. But I have to buy my health insurance through my employer. And that just seems a little odd to me. And it's an artifact of the historic benefits that employees receive from having employer-sponsored health insurance. And a lot of those benefits, for instance, if you got really sick, you couldn't have your insurance dropped. Well, a lot of those benefits for a group health or employer health plan have gone away now. And so it's really pretty easy to go out on the insurance exchange and buy health insurance, a lot easier than it was, and you get high-quality health insurance. So what I would expect over time is once we get past this period, you'll see increasing pressure for a relaxation of this employer mandate and enabling more people to go out and buy health insurance on the insurance exchanges. You can go out to healthcare.gov and look, and there are 50 health insurance plans being offered in Oklahoma right now. And you can buy one that varies based on premiums, based on deductibles, based on all the different factors. If you want one that has a wellness plan for health, for heart problems, then you can get one that specializes in that. So you get all this choice, all this information. But for most of us, we don't get that choice and that information because of the employer mandate, because I don't get to choose my health plan, my employer does. I think over time, there will be increasing pressure to relax that, giving us all more choices, more information, and more efficiency in the market.
Wow, that's interesting. Get relaxed over time because they will be more astute as to what their options are. Okay, any other weigh-in on that question?
I forecast that the health problem will be with us for decades to come. We'll never really come to any real solution. And it's sad. I'm not sure there is a solution. I wish we had greater accountability. I see a lot of people that weigh a whole lot more than they should. Of course, I don't include myself in that group, but we need education of our children in terms of healthy lifestyles. We have to recognize that there are inherent problems. All the bad calories for you are cheap calories, and so it's a tough nut, and I don't really see any solution.
I would say generally sort of unrelated to healthcare. I always think about uncertainty in business conditions and economic outcomes. It often has less to do with the level of uncertainty and the change in uncertainty. It's that differential of things becoming more uncertain or more certain. And so with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, I think businesses are starting to adjust that it's the reality. And so, you know, you have these things that are marginal changes in the level of uncertainty, but I don't see it being a real you know, factor that forces business conditions. And then we had the midterm elections and Supreme Court taking up the...
And everything changed again.
Right? So, changed. Exactly. So, you know, sort of right as I had this thought, then, you know, you have these two events that really could affect that change in uncertainty. And to Mickey's point, could, in the short term, have some investment decisions as firms try to decide what's their optimal size, what's their optimal investment pattern, as they try to sort through what's coming next.
Do you want to...
Well, the only thing I could maybe echo what Mickey said about expanding Medicaid is if you put that to a cost-benefit analysis, my suspicion is that would have a higher benefit-cost ratio than most of our tax credit programs. So if you looked at it purely on a dollar flow, I mean, this is a huge amount of dollars that we're paying in taxes are not coming back to us. We're just letting them flow out. And guess what? When they come back to us, well, we collect state taxes on those. You know, so that's just sort of like any other economic development program that you were envisioning, that you think there's some cost, but you're getting the income in return, and you get to tax that. And that's not to mention maybe the improved health outcomes of people that we know from economics improves employee productivity. So I understand the cost concerns. I've had my cost concerns with the act itself. But given that it's law, and given that we're already paying, we should be taking that money back.
Gotcha. My final question before we turn it over to the audience for their Q&A is directed back to Bob, and that's the federal economic policy. In a recent discussion of Federal Reserve monetary policy, the Wall Street Journal noted that history offers little guidance for the months ahead. The Fed has never wrapped up a $4 trillion stimulus program before and has no experience raising rates from zero. Apparently, Janet Yellen and others would disagree. What is right? And why? No small question to ask.
Well, my colleagues here are always happy for me to take the brunt of this kind of question because I'm much closer to retirement than they are. As you know, many of you know, I'm quite a cynic, yet I am happy to report that there is no recession on the horizon. I follow a lot of news, read a lot of blogs and other people's opinions about where the economy is and where it's heading. Also look at the Chicago National Activity Index, Chicago Fed National Activity Index. The Fed has come out with a recent new index called the Labor Market Conditions Index, where they dynamically compile a number of variables into one series. It gives us very good projections about, very good foreshadowing about whether we're headed into a recession or not. So I'm quite pleased to report this time last year I was a little more concerned that we might be heading into a downturn, and since we were touching on zero on some of those measures. But the most recent data is quite, I wouldn't say extremely robust. I'm not saying we're going to reach some sort of liftoff where we start growing at the more respectable 3% and 4% rates. I still think we're going to be hovering around 2% to 2.5% in GDP growth in real terms nationally for the maybe the foreseeable future. But God save us if we were to enter a recession, because I feel that the Fed has run out of ammunition. Of course, for the last 6 years now, I've felt that the Fed was running out of ammunition. But it's clear that I'm wrong, that I totally underestimated the willingness of the Eastern financial political establishment to blow up the Fed's balance sheet beyond any kind of recognition that we would imagine for what I think are comparatively small gains. It's incredible how marketing enters this these kind of dialogues nationally. We don't have money printing; we have quantitative easing. We have quantitative easing at what level? Well, at $85 billion a month, but nobody does the multiplication and say, well, isn't that $1 trillion a year in bond buying? So there's a lot of that's going on nationally to prop up the national economy. I guess some solace I feel is that I feel I still stand strong with some of our fellow Midwesterners, such as Thomas Honig, former head of the Kansas City Fed, and now Esther George, who is the current head of the Kansas City Fed, and Richard Fisher, who's president of the Dallas Fed, have all been among those dissenters questioning the Fed's largesse. There's something about us in the heartland who are just somewhat suspicious about money for nothing. And that's what bothers me. I think the Fed was complicit in much of the failing of our financial system. We had the Greenspan put for years, and what do we mean by that? We mean Greenspan stood ready to have the Fed to the rescue any time that the financial markets had a hiccup, no matter how big that hiccup seemed to be. It was cavalry to the rescue. And as a consequence, the smart people on Wall Street figured out the Fed has your back, and why not take even more risk? And I think that that kind of moral hazard has put us in this circumstance. Of course, following the Greenspan put, we had the Bernanke put, and I guess to follow that is the Yellen put. We don't have to buy insurance ourselves. The Fed is going to buy it for us in case we get into any trouble. So, but now they tell us that quantitative easing is over. I'd like to believe them. Unless, of course, there are problems. And, of course, we had just last month the stock market fall by 9 or 10%. And what do we then see immediately in the news? Well, James Bullard, president of the St. Louis Fed, comes out and says, well, we just may have to delay the end of quantitative easing if conditions warrant. And, of course, the stock market immediately reversed course and is now setting new highs. Even Alan Greenspan is now saying that that it'll be difficult for the Fed to return to normalcy in interest rates for the economy. But when has Greenspan ever gotten anything right? So I'm not too concerned about that. And I certainly admit that my concerns about this expansion of what we used to call the bank excess reserves, we used to call that high-powered money because it was capable of being multiply expanded in the economy. And I've certainly been much too concerned about inflation, but I'm not changing my forecast because someday I will be right. So don't worry. QE, quantitative easing, is dead. Long live quantitative easing.
You know, you may be cynical in your own opinion, but we don't think so. You're very insightful and appreciate your remarks. I tell you what, I want to open it up to the audience for your questions. but if anybody, so if you'll raise your hand, someone from the chamber will come with a microphone. Don't be intimidated. Just because they're very intellectual, there are no dumb questions. Some more intellectual than others, I'm teasing. We have, okay.
Okay, so Dr. Doffenbach, I appreciate your insight very much. I'm your average Joe. I have 401k. I graduated from college in 2004 and was told that there will not be Social Security for me, so I'm on my own, so be sure to invest and work it out, which is what I've been doing. But then I see our national debt exceeding $16 trillion, and our GDP is $16 trillion, so we've kind of, you know, $100,000 mortgage with a $100,000 a year salary. So what, I guess long-term, is my strategy okay with planning my 401k to retire?
I'm not qualified to speak on this issue. I think that you just periodically and consistently and methodically increase your savings. I know you're not getting any kind of return for it now. Maybe someday you will. And certainly the approach that the financial analysts recommend, and I have to admit it's done pretty well over time, and that's a balanced approach. Some bonds, some stock at that 50% level for each, but heading more towards bonds the older you get. So take a little more risk at present. I think in your situation, young, a little bit of money to put in the market. We've got weakness in many energy services companies that I think will, you know, don't hold me to this, and I'm not licensed in this area, but I think are certainly good long-term bets. So I like the energy industry and what we're seeing there in many respects.
Yeah, I would say I just have to make a comment that I think it's terrible that you graduated in 2004, and we see this all the time with young people convinced that they will not have any Social Security available for them when they retire. And what it does is sort of takes that generation out of the Social Security fight, and they reconcile themselves to the fact that they're going to go through life and pay much higher taxes to support the retirement of the baby boomer generation ahead of them, and then when they get there, there's not going to be anything there. And then when they get there and they find out there's a little something there, it feels like the raw deal they got wasn't quite as raw as they thought it was going to be, right? And it is very much a raw deal, and I think there will be some Social Security there, not nearly as much as should be there for you, and I hope that my generation and younger can get involved in looking today for a Social Security solution that doesn't impose all of the costs on us, but very little of the benefits to us. Beyond that, on the Federal Reserve comment, I would just add that, you know, the challenge I see with the Federal Reserve is I don't know that they know what normalcy means to them right now, whether it's normal interest rates or normal-sized balance sheets, or as I interact with folks at the Federal Reserve that I know and I listen to speak at conferences, some say, well, we need to get interest rates off of zero back to more normal interest rates. Some say, well, we've got to get the balance sheet back to a more normal size. Esther George has said, well, we've got to get the balance sheet back balanced between its long-term and short-term assets. Forget about the size of the balance sheet. We just want the ratio of long to short-term assets to be what they have historically been. And it's not real clear that either the Board of Governors or the branch presidents, the open market committee has a plan, a working definition of what the normal is that they're trying to return to, much less a way to get to that point of normalcy.
I think they're going to try to do it incrementally. I mean, they said that they really are going to try to be as creative in unwinding it as they were in getting us in it. But what you want to avoid is doing it too drastically.
Right.
So they're going to try to do it incrementally. They're going to let a lot of the bonds expire, can gradually shrink it. Obviously, you don't go back to where you were because the economy has grown. But there will be hiccups, right? There's going to be unintended consequences. They have financial instruments they're going to use. Sometimes they're going to work. Sometimes they're not going to work the way they hoped.
I believe we have a question over here.
Yes, you mentioned that there were better ways to improve poverty rather than controlling the minimum wage. Two-part question. One, what are those? And secondly, what is the long-term effect of a widening poverty class and its greater gap from the upper and middle classes?
Heavy question.
That's a heavy question. Sounds like
Mickey?
First off, if we think about it from a federal level, it's pretty clear that whenever you increase the minimum wage, there are some increases in earnings for people at the lower end of the wage scale, some, because some people also have a harder time finding employment. But you have some increase in earnings. But more than half of the benefit of that goes to people actually living in poverty. Much of the benefit of increasing minimum wage goes to people who are living outside of poverty, like teenagers, young adults who come from families that aren't living in poverty. But another program, such as expanding the earned income tax credit, is a program where 97% of the benefits of expanding that go directly to the families in poverty. And so I've always argued that a much more effective tool, if we really want to help families who are struggling, living day to day, week to week, and paycheck to paycheck, the earned income tax credit and programs like that are much more effective at making a difference in their lives than raising the minimum wage would be. The minimum wage is popular to talk about, but it's not as effective at actually changing lives as in expanding the earned income tax credit. But if you have a problem where we don't address poverty issues in our society, we run an increased risk of creating a disgruntled, alienated class who aren't willing to participate legally in an economy and help it grow. They aren't willing to make the investments in their own education to improve their human capital because they don't see a payoff for it. And that disgruntledness, that lack of desire and passion and hope and optimism has long-term economic impacts because it lowers the level of human capital attainment, lowers the level of innovation and investment. Essentially, we're taking a large chunk of our population and turning them off from giving us their best.
Any other questions? I think we probably are running out of time, and you're probably wondering where your main course is, so it'll be on its way. But it's so four assets of Oklahoma's economy sits right here. They are so intellectual and so outstanding. And Russell, I have a question.
Shoot.
Is it half empty or half full now?
I think I'm leaning towards the half full.
All right. Great answer. Thank y'all so much. Appreciate it.